these were.
Okay, so good morning. We're jumping into the Song of Solomon again, and 2 weeks ago I did a bit of an introduction. Last week we got started into chapter one, and what I'm going to do, as I did last week, is share the screen so we can see the text as we're going through it. I'm looking at a more modern translation, but I'm going to show the King James on the screen on the video, and also. I've added something I didn't have last week, which is I've added in the high level outline of the book. And hopefully this is big enough to see, but this is a high level, I've added in, you'll see at the top of the screen, introduction and then wedding day. But this is just to denote the main sections of the book, and I'll make it a little bigger. What I think are the main sections, and obviously people can disagree, and I'm going to show you some tough passages in chapter two, and I'll show you in a number of verses kind of how people might take it a different way, and it's food for thought. There's great value when you work through a book and coming up with an outline of your own, and the purpose of this really high level outline is to help you with at least where I think the song is chronologically, because as we talk about this woman Shulamit, we will find her name later in the book, but she's remembering, she's looking back as she sings, and she's not remembering everything chronologically, which would make it so much easier for us. Parts of it are chronological, but she seems to start at the ending in some sense. That is, she starts at what I think is the wedding day. I think they're at a banquet. But later, she's going to go back and explore how she felt, where her emotions were prior to the wedding. And as the days were coming, but she was longing for the wedding day, but, it was still out there in the future. And in that context, you'll get to hear how her Solomon was thinking as well from what he will say. So, not strictly chronological, but this will help us. The other thing I've done is, as I mentioned last week, is I've noted who is speaking. If you look in most modern translations, they will in one way or another note who speaks. That's an editor has added that, of course. It's not in the original text. It's helpful. Not all translations, not all commentators agree 100%. But there tends to be a fairly good agreement on most of it. So there's just small places typically where people may disagree about who the speaker is. But it's helpful for us too, because these are some of the biggest challenges we have with reading this book. Who is talking? It's not chronological. And then the biggest part, of course, is challenging metaphors. And something I'll say that I don't think I said last week, if I suggest a view of it that you find skeptical, it could be because I'm wrong, but hold the thought until we've kind of gone through the whole book, because one of the things that happens as you study the whole book is you see these themes get repeated. And once you see them get repeated, I think it brings clarity to what has happened. And I was thinking about this week, about how the Song of Solomon, you have to read through it several times, and you start seeing more, each time you read through it, you see more and more themes that are repeated, maybe not in the exact same words, and it begins to spring to life a bit. And it reminded me, there was a song that was cut the year I was born by a singer named Don McLean. He had a song called American Pie, and if you know what I'm talking about, the song's like nearly 10 minutes long, and it's a sort of a tribute to Buddy Holly and remembering Buddy Holly, another singer's death in the late 1950s in a plane crash. It's a bizarre song, and because it's so long, it is chock full of metaphors. It is full of them. And it's one of those songs that here and there I'll see articles written where they're trying to get Don McLean himself to explain what all this means. But it is something that as you listen to it several times through, you start maybe at least getting an idea of what you think some of the metaphors mean. Kind of like that. And I think music, songs often use metaphors. And it presents a big danger for the expositor, especially a dispensationalist who's used to trying to find a very literal interpretation of everything. They're metaphors for literal things, but it's easy to not recognize something as a metaphor. And that's what I mean about the dispensationalists getting in a bit of trouble in interpreting is when they don't see that, oh, this is a metaphor, it's a figure of speech or something. So with that said, we'll kind of jump in. We covered part of chapter one and just high level. What I've suggested is that she's reminiscing about the wedding day. And remember, this is going to become important throughout the song, that with the tradition about how betrothal and marriage worked with the Jewish people, I mean, you even see this in several other places in scripture, and you see the imagery in chapter one that, not chapter one, in the New Testament that deals with this Jewish concept of betrothal and the wedding day. There's usually a betrothal period for about a year. The marriage is not consummated during that time. It's more than being engaged in the way that we think of it in the modern world, but it's a bit less than being married in the way we think of it in the modern world. It's something in between because it has legal effect to be betrothed. It's not something that you readily undo. And so after this 1 year period of time, and it's not on a set date, there's some, on the part of the bride, she does not know exactly when, but at a point in time, the groom will come and to her home, and it'll be near the evening time, and he will take her to his home where he has prepared a special room. Perhaps the room he grew up in, but now it's been made for a room for both of them, and he's remodeled it more or less. And they'll have a wedding feast that evening. And at some point during the wedding feast, they'll exit and go off in private and consummate the wedding. And then they may come back and continue the feast. And this feast may be celebrated for several days. So that at a high level is kind of there. And you see this in the New Testament. I've mentioned before, John 14, the opening verses uses the imagery. But when Jesus talks about his second coming, you know, he even uses a parable in Matthew 25 of the young women who are, they're not the one being married. They're the ones that are going to be part of the marriage party. And we sometimes call it the parable of the 10 young virgins or the 10 young women. And five of them have oil in their lamps when the groom's party shows up at night to pick up the bride. And five of them don't have oil in their lamps, and the idea is they can't make their way through the city to get to where the marriage feast is going to be. And then at the end of the parable, when those five foolish young women finally knock on the door at the wedding banquet, they're not allowed in. That builds off this type of imagery I'm talking about. So just having that in mind will help us a bit as we get into chapter two. I think help us understand it. So the reason I said this is a reminiscence of the wedding day, you know, it's not obvious right at first, but she does talk about being in verse four drawn or enticed, wooed into the king's chambers, the bedroom, but also and you see Shulamit speaks in verses 5-7 there and part of verse four. And we talked there about how she has some things to say where she views herself as attractive, but also with some unattractive features. And she calls out her tan, and we'll talk more about that. And then though, when you get to verse 9, 10, and 11, Solomon is looking at her and describing her appearance, and it would seem it's her appearance fully clothed. And I say that because later in the book we'll get a more vivid description in a sense where there won't be any mention of the clothing. But it's not just that she's clothed. She's clothed for her wedding, it would seem. She is arrayed as Pharaoh's horses that drew his chariots, which were known for the way they would literally kind of put a costume on the horse. And she's got the jewels of gold and then it says in verse 12, a king is at his table. And that suggests that they're at the wedding banquet and he's at his table. And that's kind of the reason I suggest that, it is the wedding banquet. Okay. Is probably what's in mind. Now, one of the real challenging passages we talked about last week, it occurs right here in verse 7, when she says, tell me, you know, you who my soul loves, where you feed, that is where you take your sheep, your flock of sheep, because she pictures him as a shepherd. And the challenge for us is her lover, her betrothed, a shepherd? And she doesn't know where he's at. He's lost as far as she's concerned. She has no idea where he is. Or is it a metaphor and he's not really a shepherd? She's going to call on Solomon later. He's going to be introduced to Solomon, who certainly is no shepherd. And what I suggested, and I think it'll become a little more evident, maybe even a little later in what we get to today, is that this is a metaphor. And what she's remembering is she reminisces back a little before the wedding is the feeling of separation from him because there were, these boundaries in the relationship. And in particular, they could not consummate the wedding and they couldn't live together yet and all those things. And so in poetic words, it would be as if, you know, there probably were days she didn't see him. It's as if he's lost, like, and then this uses the common imagery of a shepherd. And when they leave the town and take their flock somewhere, they're going to go and find grass and you don't know where they're at. So that's my suggestion. The other view that's common is that throughout this song, she has a real lover, a secret lover that's this shepherd, a young country boy like her. She's a young country girl living in Lebanon, as people will say. And Solomon has found out about her. In fact, she probably works a vineyard that Solomon owns, and he's found out about her, and he's going to marry her, and even though she really wants to be married to the shepherd. So it's a really common view. I would say, just to have it in mind as we get through more of the text, I think there's no support really for that view, and it's all built on this verse 7, but it's commonly held, and you can judge as you see further in the text. I'm going to show you pretty soon why a verse like 7 needs to be understood as a metaphor, and we need to be careful. For all we know, this man she's betrothed to doesn't even own a single lamb, so we'll see that. Remember who the daughters are. They're the young, women of marriageable age. And before the wedding, Shulamit is a part of this group. That's sort of, that's her peer group, if you will. And just as the book of Proverbs, for a large part of it, Solomon, if you read what he says, it reads as a father giving instruction or wisdom to a son. In this book, she, Shulamit, will direct her wisdom toward these daughters, this group of young marriageable women of whom she was a part up to the point of being married. And then she makes a transition to being, a wife. And so that's who they are. And we'll see in a bit the wisdom she'll give them. But what's important is they give a good transition. Verse 7, she's kind of talking out loud. And more or less is saying, where is my beloved? And then the daughters, they answer her in verse 8. And they tell her, well, if you don't know, why don't you go and just follow the footprints of his flock of sheep and go as far as that'll get you. And then just wait there. When you get to the area where shepherds hang out and they've got their tents set up, just wait there and until he finds you, seems to be the idea. So they answer her, and sometimes she will even kind of answer back. So we're going to see some of that in the song. In verse 9, we saw Solomon speaking, You say, well, how do we know he's speaking? Because it's what he says. It's what's said here. He's comparing his love to the beauty of how Pharaoh's horses are arrayed in what looks like clothing and jewels and so forth. This doesn't fit her descriptions of him. It's clear that I think he's describing a female, and so we know he's speaking. And then she responds. This is all stuff we talked about last week, but it just gives us some grounding for the new stuff. She responds and says the king's at his table, and that's what really grounds it for me, that it's brought us up to the day of the wedding, and she's at the ceremony or at the feast. So she says, while the king sits at his table, her spikenard, it's an old word, but it's a liquid perfume, sends forth its smell. This is not surprising because if you remember earlier on, and I'll just scroll up a second, she made the comment that, in verse 3 of her lover, we'll call him Solomon, that because of the savor, the fragrance of his perfumes or colognes, if you want to think of it that way, she said that basically the young women, they adore him. The word for love there is adore. It's not anything sexual. He has that reputation. And when she says in verse 3, his name is like the ointment poured forth, it's the idea of a really strong, potent perfume, and if you just poured out the whole bottle, the smell would fill the room. His reputation is like that. People know who he is, and there's no surprise to her that the young women love him. But that theme, that concept of using the perfume is something she's coming back to down here when they're the king's at the table. And it's like the smell of her perfume is sort of reaching to him to draw him to her. And she doubles down on that in verse 13. Myrrh is also used as a perfume, but it's more of a hard perfume, not a liquid. And so they would put the myrrh in a little leather pouch, and a lady would wear it over, under her clothing. And wear it, on a necklace, like on a leather strap, and it would be right between her breast. And so she uses that imagery that people knew about, and sort of builds on the idea of the sense of smell. Okay. So the sense of smell in verse 12, the cologne or the perfume sending forth its smell. So the king, he not only sees her, he smells her. And then verse 13, just like her little bundle of myrrh that she would wear under her clothes between her breasts, she talks about Solomon being that way, that he would lie with her all night between her breasts. And then she uses one more piece of imagery that's, again, the sense of smell. So just think of this. She's going to use things that were common in the ancient world that they understood. And a lot of it is going to be plants, animals, some places that are architectural marvels that people know about, and things like smell. And here she says, my beloved is unto me as a cluster of it's an old word, it's henna, it's the henna blossoms. And she specifically says in the vineyards, or you could read like the oasis of En Gedi, there was a well-known location by the Dead Sea, which is dead. And if you ever look at pictures of it, it's just surrounded by more or less dry dirt. But there is a little oasis there that has these henna blossoms that in the right season give it a pleasant fragrance, right? And so she views him, metaphor, as that bundle of myrrh between her breasts. He's that close to her. She views him, again, using the sense of smell, as a cluster of these fragrant blossoms that you get there in En Gedi. So terms of affection, but also longing to consummate the wedding, to be close to him. And I think that's about how far we got last time. So I know that's all kind of review, but it helps ground us. He's going to tell her how beautiful she is. And that's important because we're going to see, as we saw in chapter one, remember she said she had a tan. In our culture, that's a thing. People even paint themselves if they don't have a tan. You can buy, apparently, you know, paint yourself and try to change your skin color. But in the ancient world, it doesn't seem like that's what they were after, which is a deep dark tan. And so she kind of called that out, and the daughters of Jerusalem gave her assurance, and Solomon will give her assurance that she is beautiful. And so he says in verse 15 of chapter one that she's fair, meaning, an old word for beautiful, a King James word, and she has dove's eyes. And this is one of those things that people will that write books on this song will spend all kinds of time debating, and I don't think it's that hard. But what do dove's eyes look like? When I was writing my book, I actually went and looked at a bunch of pictures of dove's eyes on the internet, trying to get a sense for it. But I think her eyes are a striking feature. And if they are at a wedding ceremony at this point in the ancient world, there isn't a whole lot of shulamit that, you can see her hair, but it's under a veil. Think in modern days, there's still parts of the world where women are dressed where the only thing you can see is their eyes. At this point in time for this wedding, it's very likely that there was very little that you could see of her skin other than the area right at her eyes. So her eyes are all already a striking feature, but given the scene, that they're probably one, the one feature that would maybe catch Solomon's eyes. And so he calls that out. Having dove's eyes doesn't tell us if she had blue eyes or brown eyes. It doesn't matter. It is clearly intended to indicate some beauty. And throughout the song, animals are going to be used for imagery to convey a beauty or virility and that sort of thing. She responds to him in verse 16. And also verbalizes her feelings, says, "You're fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant." And then she has this interesting statement, our bed is green. In verse 17, the beams of our house are cedar and our rafters are fir. There's a couple of ways to take this. What I want to suggest to you is that a lot of the song we'll use the metaphor of a change of seasons. And as you go from, as you go into the spring season, the vegetation is green. The little animals are out. The vegetation's growing. You begin to see fruit on the vines of the trees, that sort of thing. And we're going to see that imagery throughout. And the idea is there's a time in their relationship where there's boundaries, but as the season changes and it's springtime, and that's when you can smell all these things like the henna blossoms and see the animals out, it's representative of the fact that times have changed in their relationship as well, so that now it's time to be married and to consummate the wedding. And so one way of viewing this thing, our bed is green, she's going to view her body. She talked about it earlier as a vineyard. She'll talk about it later as a garden. And our bed is green is probably not literally about the bed in their bedroom, okay? But at the same time, I think she's saying green because when all the vegetation is green, springtime is here. It's just a way of saying, it's ready. This is the time when everything is ready, the appropriate time for them to be consummating the wedding. And we're going to see a whole lot more about, things being, certain colors and vegetation growing. But that verse 17, you could view it in two ways. You could imagine that they are laying on the ground somewhere outside, so that their bed, in a real sense, is green, if it's the springtime. And as they lay down, they look up and they can see cedar trees and fir trees. And so it pictures an outdoor scene where they're laying down. I think what she's saying is that our bed is green, is that it is ready. And the beams of the house are cedar. He will prepare a room for her during the betrothal period that he will bring her to when they, to live there, but also to consummate the wedding. And cedar trees and fir trees are not common, certainly in Israel. The cedar trees usually came, at least the big ones, came from Lebanon. And I think she's saying that the interior of their bedroom has been completed. And so it has the beams and the rafters in it. And it's just a way of saying, sort of now we're at the time to consummate the wedding. So, those are a couple different views of that. Let me stop there, see if there's a comment or question so far before we, ruin a really great old hymn in the next verse. Any comments, thoughts so far? Okay. Well,
I'm still wondering what Solomon has to do with this woman.
Well, it's a good question. And if you corner me on it, I don't think this is about the real Solomon, though I think he wrote it.
Okay.
But that's a part of the big debate about the book, right? Because I think it's just a song. I don't even know that Shulamit's a real person.
Right.
And I will tell you from conservative kind of dispensational view, which only matters here for, trying to find a literalness as opposed to spiritualizing the text and making it about Israel and God. It's a real common view that it is Solomon, that it is really Solomon, which means, right, that she's one of his many wives. Okay. And, how many women did Solomon have?
Too many.
Yeah. Right. And so I'm not saying that can't be right. I'm just saying it does present some natural challenges.
Yeah. I don't think she'd be all that thrilled, but then,
it's hard to say because, let me say this. Money goes a long way for a lot of people. But nothing she says sounds like that's who she is.
No, it doesn't.
She's deeply in love with him. And what I would suggest, and it's not uncommon in the ancient literature, is Solomon as a name, as a character in a sense, is also a metaphor here. She really is getting married. And in her world, this man has all the richness, and I don't mean monetary, of Solomon. But just know that it's a very common view among those who like me try to give a literal interpretation of this as being about two lovers or three, as I've said. Some throw a shepherd in there. They do view Solomon as the real Solomon. And so there's no end to the debates about whether this song represents history. That is, he really married a young girl named Shulamit. And then you get, and we'll see later why, but there's going to be references to her coming from Lebanon. So that gets you in an interesting place because some people would say, well, this would make sense if it was about his first wife, but his first wife was Egyptian, not Lebanese. And so then you've got to say, well, let's just say she's wife number 100. Does the song, does it have the same power, and force? We haven't got to the punchline yet. We're going to get to the punchline here just in a bit, but you have to think about that. And I'm just suggesting that you have lots of defenses you have to make to how this is really about a woman and Solomon who seem to be, even though they don't explicitly say it, they seem to be celebrating the joy of a monogamous relationship. I mean, they just do. And even in chapter 8, when we fast forward later in time, I have to think her view might be a bit different, and maybe even Solomon's, if, you know, she's one among his vast harem of beautiful women. And verse 2 that we're fixing to see kind of gets to that kind of point. So, yeah, no, but it's a question to keep in mind the whole time. And then as you go through the entire book and see all of it, then you can kind of make a, you know, kind of come to your own conclusion about it. My view that it really is a song, that it is to convey, it's a love song, like the Egyptian love poetry, intended to convey both wisdom, but also emotions and feelings, means I don't need to defend the fact that Solomon was married to many women, because I'm not even suggesting that necessarily the male character here is Solomon. So I see another hand raised.
Yeah, I think this is a very good discussion, because that's always a issue that I've had with the Song of Solomon, is that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, right? And I don't think those are literal numbers. I think they're symbolic numbers. Seven's the number of perfection. Three's the number of completion. I just think it means he had, like, so many wives, so many concubines. It was outrageous. If this is a real, you know, relationship, I just don't think he could have the capacity. And I don't think she, it seems out of character, right? It seems to be a contradiction. So I think if it's just a poem, then I think it makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it. You verbalize exactly kind of what steered me this way. And I will say, when I first studied the Song of Solomon at Bible College, I did accept that this was about Solomon. And so that drove me to say, well, maybe he had more than one wife, but it had to be earlier on in life. Maybe she's number two or three. Because as Judd pointed out, Solomon didn't go to bed with the same woman 2 days in a row. He certainly didn't need to. And this just doesn't fit. I also had accepted at that time, because that's kind of where the professor had presented it, is that Solomon's really stealing her away from her real lover that she wants to marry. And that was a way, you know, of taking a view that it's really Solomon and that this is history, but also explaining the problem with Solomon that Judd just mentioned, having all these wives, right? Because if she doesn't want to marry him and she wants to marry the shepherd, then the book takes on an entirely different color. And you don't, but you don't have to defend Solomon because he's the bad guy in the story. It seems unlikely to me that Solomon would write a song, where he is the bad guy. No, but those are views that are out there. Look what she says in chapter 2, verse 1. Remember, we're still in this section I call wedding day, and it's gonna come to a close in verse 7 here in a moment, but, there's an old song, and I love the tune. It's, you know, I have a background with churches that sing hymns, out of real hymnals and all that. And there's a song called The Lily of the Valleys. You've probably heard it. And I've even heard sermons and seen, you know, posters and things where, you know, and banners made, you know, Jesus is the bread of life. He's the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. This rose of Sharon, lily of the valleys, you know, even in an interpretation that takes the song to be an allegory for Jesus and the church, Jesus is not, you know, because in that interpretation, Solomon is the figure for Jesus. It's not Solomon talking. It's the female talking. And we know that because in verse 2, we'll talk about what verse 1 means, but in verse 2, he answers her and says, as a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. That leaves no doubt that verse 1 is the female talking. So the idea that Jesus is the Rose of Sharon, the Lily of the Valley, is it sounds good, but it's just not so. The other thing is, it's not a compliment. There's just an assumption when I hear these things, we hear that song, you know, he's the Lily of the Valleys. It's not a compliment. Okay. And it's the reason Solomon answers the way he does. Now, Sharon is a coastal area up in northern Israel. And she's describing something that's common. It doesn't mean that she's ugly. She's not saying that. She's just saying, I'm really not different than the other women, the other, young daughters of Jerusalem that we call the chorus. I'm just a rose of Sharon. Lots of roses there. Just a lily in the valleys. Lilies everywhere. It's common. And that's why his response to her, as he will always through this book, he builds her up, against any self-doubts. And this is, it's an interesting phenomenon because, you know, I mean, everybody has areas of self-doubt. I mean, just about. And if they don't, then they're people we really don't want to know. but because their pride tells them they don't need to have any self-doubt anywhere. But you know, within relationships and certainly within a marriage, you know, building people up, right? It ought to be if in no other relationship, certainly the marriage relationship, you ought to know you're both on the same team. And it's an important part of what the song has to say to everybody, not just young people that aren't married yet, about verbalizing things and being a source of encouragement and building one another up, even in areas maybe of insecurity or self-doubt. So she says, I'm just a common rose. No, she's clearly not a rose and she's not a lily, right? Metaphors everywhere. But once we understand that these are common things, a rose in that area of the country, a lily in the valley, super common things. He says, you know what? You're not uncommon at all. From his perspective, and he's not putting down the other women, from his perspective, if all the lilies out there, you know, she is a lily among thorns. Okay. So what are the thorns? The other women. It doesn't mean they're bad. Doesn't mean they're unattractive. He's not saying anything about that. It's the way in which in his eyes, he exalts his beloved and he tells her that you're not just a lily of the valleys. You're a lily among thorns. So is my love among the daughters, among all the young women of this peer group she's a part of up until the marriage. She's not common or ordinary. And we wouldn't say it the same way. But in a healthy marriage, we should all be able to say that of our spouse. That's in the mindset. This is a monogamous mindset to the thing we were just discussing and Judge's comment about all the women Solomon had. If she's a lily among thorns, you certainly don't need hundreds of others, just so you can come see her once a year, you know, for bedtime. This is a very different thing, a lily among thorns. Then she responds to him and she says, as the apple tree among the trees of the wood. This is not a surprise to us, an apple tree. Notice the metaphors that they're going to frequently be things that we would identify with a garden that includes a garden with, you know, trees that bear fruit, in the ancient world. These were things to prize. In Israel, I was going to say, like, I was at Home Depot last week and they had a bunch of apple trees for sale and I've decided I'm going to buy a few and plant them on the backside of my property. Apple trees don't grow naturally in Israel. They had to be imported. Carol, see a hand raised?
Didn't sometimes kings marry other heads of state for, monetary and property to make their place more important.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm saying it right, but I think many of the times the marriages weren't for love or for sex. They're for simply for promoting their country, getting
aid from other countries or whatever.
Yeah, it was common in the ancient world. It's probably the reason. Remember, Solomon, as I recall, his first wife was a daughter of the Egyptian pharaoh.
Right. And so I don't see any problem so far with her being a favorite among all these women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's if we take Solomon literally, that's kind of the view we would maybe take, or we would put it early in time before he had so many women. But I don't think we can argue that all of those women were what would you call it, kind of political alliances, if you will. Nor do we know one way or the other whether he really had affection for Pharaoh's daughter. He may have. It may have been something that satisfied, you know, it sort of, you know, accomplished more than one thing. Solomon is a womanizer, though, and it's his undoing. As you read the whole story of his life, the concubines, the hundreds of those are wives without the title. And so I guess, you know, I agree with what you said. There is a way to provide, a plausible way this could happen, and she could just be his favorite. But I do think as you get further into his life, when he has so many, these aren't all, they can't all be, you know, just marriages of convenience for an alliance or what have you. But I have no doubt there were some of those, yeah.
That's just kind of my thought right now, but I'm sure can change as along.
No, and it's a good idea, and you may not change it, and that's fine too. That's why I wanted to share. A lot of people think the song is really about, you know, Solomon and real wife, and that's fine. And frankly, they can still interpret a lot of the verses the same way I do. They just have to defend those who will challenge their views, particularly because of the life of Solomon and how it ended. Solomon allowed his women to bring idols into the temple, right in the complex, not in the interior of the structure, but in the complex, and it's the undoing of his kingdom. It leads to God, you know, doesn't take it away from him, but with his son doesn't have the whole thing. He ends up with part of it, and anyway, all kinds of problems. So it's just to say that we have to defend that. And my view of it is a song. I escaped some of that, but there's probably some other things I have to defend too. So this is a hard book. I see another hand raised.
Yeah, I think first of all, to have those multiple wives, Solomon had to break the Mosaic law because your kings are not to multiply wives. So he was breaking the law, first of all. Second of all, even if they were just political unions, he still had to consummate them, right? So he consummated all those marriages. And then third of all, to your point, not only did he allow them to bring, you know, idols into the temple, but it says he actually built temples for their gods. So he was really with this, these relationships with women that he had, he was just, and then, you know, the 700 wives and 300 concubines, what all that is telling you is that, and, you know, it literally says he went away from the Lord because he let his wives turn his heart away from the Lord. So he was totally and utterly out of control with women.
And I wanted to say that. For me, Ecclesiastes was a book that growing up in Boca Raton with young children and having so many people with so much money and the whole narrative of King Solomon that he thought that the more wealth, the more women, the more success that he possessed, the happier he would be. And boy, is it a biblical illustration of personal absolute misery. If you don't have the capacity, forget it. Ecclesiastes 1 through 12 and 2 Chronicles 9:22. I feel sorry for people with money without the capacity. And I think that if it's still the same as it was when I was studying this, their suicide rate, I came from a town that half the people were very rich. And there were like 5 suicides in my high school. I feel sorry for people with money that don't have capacity. Absolutely sorry for them. I think it's a great book we're studying.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned Ecclesiastes. That's a book that, and there's debate about it. I think Solomon wrote it. That's the traditional view. But if you read that book, he basically says, I mean, it fits Solomon. He had all the money and all that. And he did this and did that. He accomplished everything, learning. He poured himself into hedonism, and he came out with nothing. And, you know, and it's, it doesn't fit well with the song either. The song, you know, if the song is really just about Solomon, another problem we run into is that, of course this girl would feel the way she does. She got to marry Solomon. he was the richest man in the world. I think this song is showing us that even in a fallen world, it is possible, this is not extolling a perfect marriage, because that doesn't exist, because the other person that you, whoever you've married, is always a little less than perfect, right? But it's showing in a fallen world, and it has nothing to do with their money or their location or any of that, that there is a relationship that can bring a richness to their life, and it's capturing a part of that, which is the romantic side, but it's also conveying a wisdom that we'll want to talk more about as we get there, as to why this is wise. you think of our modern culture, and this is just building off what was just commented on, that the rate of depression, which is certainly, it's a real thing. It's a thing Christians experience too. And I don't say this, and you understand, anyone on the recording, I'm not criticizing anyone who now has or has suffered with bouts of depression. It's a reality, and it's a reality that's on the rise. And behind birth control on our college campuses, the most common medication being prescribed there are antidepressants. It's a real problem. And one of the reasons it's a real problem is what we're reading about. People are not forming real relationships. And they're having, you know, this book is showing us a side of physical romance that's built on a real relationship. These people care about each other, and what our culture is pursuing is just the physical part of it without the rest. And that particular issue, and there's lots of studies on this, is part of what is behind. It's not the whole thing. It's one of the things that's lending itself to this depression and then the suicide rate. So there's we get in a weird spot when we say, well, God, we hear what you're saying, but you're old fashioned, you're out of date. God knows how we're designed. Well, let's look at what Shulamit says to her Solomon here. As an apple tree, again, she picks an uncommon thing in Israel. They had them, but you had to import them. It wasn't a native thing. He's an apple tree among the other trees in the forest, right? Remember, she's not just a lily. She's a lily among thorns. He's an apple tree among the other trees. You see how they're playing off each other with that same thing, the uniqueness. This doesn't even tell me, this tells me nothing about what this man looks like. And of course, she's not even really talking about physical appearance. This is something different. What makes him extraordinary? What makes her extraordinary? We'll get glimpses of that. But the key to it is they're extraordinary in one another's eyes. And this kind of statement, you know, is powerful. So is my beloved among the sons. That's how you know she's talking and not him. He said, so are you among the daughters. She says, so are you among the sons. They're going back and forth. And then she says, I sat under his shadow. Remember, he's like an apple tree with great delight. His fruit was sweet to my taste. Now, I think she's reminiscing as they get up to the point of consummating the marriage, because verse 4 says, he brings me to the banqueting house, right? He's brought her to the feast for the wedding. But I will tell you, her relationship to him has a sustaining feature in her life. Now, this part about, she's under his shadow, like she's sitting under the tree, and his fruit, like an apple, is sweet to my taste. I think we need to not push that too far. I think she's looking back at a time where she's still looking forward to the wedding being completed and then making love to him. But I have heard well-known expositors, and I'll just kind of maybe categorize it this way. While the Song of Solomon does not get enough attention in being taught in churches, there have been some who have given it a lot of attention, which is good, but I think they did it in a very bad way. And there was a preacher in the Dallas, Texas area who essentially got a bed and put it on top of the roof of the church and was sitting or laying in it or something, is kind of advertising their Song of Solomon. A series is basically, if nothing else will get people to church, if you tell them we're going to talk about sex, they'll come. And anyway, one of the interesting things that he teaches about this, I'm just going to say it because we're adults here, is that verse 3 is about Shulamit giving Solomon oral sex. And I say that because the song will never give us real details. It will be obvious that they will make love and consummate the wedding, but it doesn't show us a video, and it's not a book that's a how-to book, and it's not a book that says, because this is the questions that were getting asked in the context of the sermon I mentioned. People were saying, well, can a married couple do this? Can they do that? And the song doesn't get to that. The song extols their physical romance, their lovemaking, without telling us in sequence what they're doing. And it's clear that it's fully consensual, and that it's not just one side, and to say consensual is not enough. They both desire to engage in this, and they're married. But be very hesitant to take a verse like verse 3 and decide that, okay, this is telling me specifically what they're doing in the bedroom, because it's not. He is like apple tree among all the other trees. And apples, apple trees provide apples, and they are good to taste, and they sustain you. You can they help support life. And in their relationship, he is like that. He is a sustaining part of to her. Which isn't a surprise, because he just told her how awesome she is. She's a lily among thorns. So he brings her to the banqueting house. His banner over me was love. That word love is not the word for love making, the word dode. It's the word for affection. His banner over me, a banner, you know what a banner is. This is saying that all his attention toward her is affection. While they're at the banqueting house, and of course there will be a time with the banqueting house where you will exit to go consummate the wedding. And in response to this, his deep affection while they're at the wedding, she says, to stay me, that is, with flagons, a real old word. I had to look it up, but it's like a raisin cake, and these little cakes in the ancient world were considered an aphrodisiac. And as she's longing for the time that they will get to go to the marriage chamber and make love. In the meantime, she says, it's kind of like, in the meantime, give me some of these raisin cakes, which again would have a sexual connotation to it as an aphrodisiac. Comfort me with apples. And then the King James says this in a weird way. I'm sick of love. That makes it sound like she wants to break up. Read it. I'm lovesick. I'm longing, to be able to be with him. And so in verse 6, she says, and this is where I think she's brought us up to the bedroom. His left hand is under her head. His right hand embraces her. And she stops. He's not going to give us a video, and that's not God's purpose. But he's gone from the banqueting house where they're celebrating the feast. It's described as if they're the only two people there, because from their perspective, they are, although they're really in a crowded room. So they have to exit and go someplace else. And then she gives her wisdom to the daughters of Jerusalem. And this will get repeated two other times in the song. It gives it unity, and it shows us not what the whole book's about, but it is the punchline of the wisdom. Just like when you're reading the book of Proverbs, Solomon will talk to his son about the dangers of the immoral woman, as she's called there. And he's telling his son about not engaging in sex with these women who are not his wife. Here she gives her charge, her wisdom to the daughters of Jerusalem, the chorus that has spoken earlier in the song. This is the group that she was a part of. She's looking back from, you know, and this is what a lot of us can do about, you know, wisdom that someone's given us, even if we didn't take it at the time. A lot of times, you know, we can look back later and see that they were right about something, but it takes that time and maturity and stuff. And so she reminisces, and she says to them, by the roes and the hinds of the field, so the, you know, sort of the deer, the antelopes and stuff, she says, she swears by them. This is a common Hebrew kind of concept in the Old Testament. People will swear by heaven and earth, because these animals will come to symbolize kind of sexuality and virility in the rest of the song. She swears by them, and here's her wisdom. Don't stir up nor awake. And that word mine is in italics because the King James added it, but it's not in the text. Don't awake love. And that's our word for lovemaking or physical love. It can be used in that way. She says, don't stir it up or awaken it. And instead of saying till he pleases, it should be before the time, basically. Don't stir it up and awaken it before the right time. And so her first charge of wisdom is she finally gets up to the point of, you know, he's taken her to the bedroom and they've embraced each other. She says to the young daughters, don't stir up this part of the marriage relationship until the proper time. That's her basic wisdom. And after that, I'm not going to start 2:8, but I just wanted to show you. I think she's going to go back in time as you read ahead, maybe for next week, she's going to go back in time. And she's going to talk about the courtship that led up to the wedding, and prominent themes here from both her and Solomon are a feeling of separation, feelings of great anticipation for the day they get to finally be married and be with one another. And it's not a surprise. I think most people that are married can remember anticipation and things like that. And so that's what she's going to go to next. Up through chapter 3, verse 5, and look at what chapter 3, verse 5 says. Same thing we just read in chapter 2. She again charges the daughters of Jerusalem to wait until the proper time, and I would say the proper person, to awaken that aspect of human relationships. So that'll be where she'll get. And lots of fascinating verses in here that have different views, and we'll cover that next time. Any closing comments or thoughts, questions?
Yeah, in Hosea 3:1, those raisin cakes are used in a very negative sense.
Yeah.
Like unfaithfulness and adultery.
Yep.
Thank you so much for doing this book. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was looking to see if you could buy raisin cakes, because I know you can buy like fig cakes, right? That mm-hmm. word raisin cakes, shisha, has to do with like something compressed. A fig cake is you take the fig and you compress it like into a little cake. It's really very tasty. They're really expensive too. Like for a small one, it'd be like $7, but they're, you know, like a ton of figs will go into them. I would love to buy one and see what it tastes like. But when I look for them for sale, it's like raisin cakes, like a cake with raisins baked into it, not like a, you know, cake of raisins.
It's something different, right? Back then, and of course they needed to be able to preserve their food, so making a raisin is something they would do. It's there's lots of verses, you know, as we get ahead, and I'm going to try to show you the different views of them, so you can, you know, hear both ideas. I try not to be dogmatic about any of them. Really, the thing I'm dogmatic about is that the song is talking about two lovers, two people that from the perspective of Shulamith, they're married now, but looking back and that the song has value today. And I think it has value for everybody, even if you're already married or, you know, or not married, it doesn't matter. And if God looks at this book and he says, wow, of all 1,005 songs this man wrote, and God gave him this extraordinary intellect to write these songs, and this was the very best, then it ought to kind of wow us as well. And if we can work through the metaphors, then I think it will. And we're going to see some fascinating language, especially the next chapter 2 and 3. We're going to see her have a dream sequence where we step into her, you know, we're already stepping into her mind while she's awake. We're going to step into her mind while she's asleep. And it's just, you know, be good stuff. I'm going to stop recording.